It's the 1st of March 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Do developments in space tourism bring us any closer to holidays in the actual sun? Is thorium the solution to all our energy needs? Why did no one vote in the PCC elections? Well, actually, maybe that should be, they were PCC elections? And can a computer be programmed to generate conspiracy theories, or is that just what they want you to think? Now, before we begin, the traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really appreciate all the donations, and they really do help us keep making the show week in, week out, even when we're on holiday like this week. So do subscribe and donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, I don't know if this is dedication or madness, but this week Liz and I are putting together the show whilst on holiday. It's been good fun, thanks for asking. But the most infuriating thing has been the roaming charges for mobile data whilst abroad, which is why when listening to this next piece by Sean on space tourism, rather than enjoy his insight and knowledge, I was instead gritting my teeth and getting angry about the cost of checking my tweets from outer space. To explain more, here's Sean.
With James and Liz on holiday this week, I decided to look at the ultimate unspoiled holiday destination. A place where there's no one else around, no development to spoil the view, and no air. Back in the 1960s, at the height of the space race, it was taken for granted that by the unimaginably distant year 2000, we'd all be holidaying on the moon in tinfoil suits, eating space pills, and generally having a marvellous time. Alas, that didn't come to pass, and it took until the 1990s before the idea of space tourism really started being taken seriously. Optimistic predictions of the growth of satellite communications got a lot of people looking at the small launch market, using new substances to make lightweight rocket designs. There were also the new internet billionaires, many of whom were the kind of people who had grown up on Star Trek. They were looking for things to do with their money, and space access was a worthy goal. The late 1990s saw a lot of small space startups touting unusual spacecraft designs. Perhaps the weirdest was Rotary Rocket, a Mojave-based company who designed a single-stage-to-orbit vehicle with a pumpless rotating engine and rotors for descent and landing. It wasn't primarily a space tourist vehicle, but it was interesting because it was manned and fully reusable. With the help of neighbour and composite material specialist Bert Rutan, they got as far as building and flying an approach and landing demonstrator, the world's tallest plastic helicopter, before running out of money in 2000. Around the same time, the sector was catalysed by a $10 million prize fund, the Ansari X Prize. If you can fly a person into space, they said, turn the same vehicle around in less than 2 weeks and send someone up again, you win the prize. Now, $10 million isn't enough to recover the cost of the development of the craft that would eventually win, but it was still a serious chunk of cash. This led to no less than 27 teams of suborbital contenders, all hoping to hop up above the 100-kilometre winning altitude and then come straight back down again. Most of these didn't get going in any meaningful way, but the winning flight was conducted in October 2004 by pilot Brian Binney in Spaceship One, built by Scale Composites, the company owned by Bert Rutan again. They remain the best bet for actually getting a commercial suborbital flight anytime soon, in the guise of Virgin Galactic. For $200,000 you get to ride in Spaceship 2, a bigger version of the XPRIZE winning design, and experience 3 minutes of weightlessness. Other companies with the potential to offer similar experiences, real soon now, honest, include Armadillo Aerospace, brainchild of computer game billionaire John Carmack. Now, a suborbital hop is a seriously cool experience, and you get to say you've been into space, but I wouldn't call it a holiday. To get a decent break, you need to get into orbit, and that's much harder. US company Space Adventures has flown 7 people as commercial passengers to the International Space Station, riding on conventional Russian Soyuz spacecraft. But supply is very limited, and now the shuttle isn't flying anymore. All seats are reserved for US and Russian cosmonauts. When the US gets back to manned flight, there may be some back on the market, at around $60 million a pop. Even at this price, though, there's enough demand to make it worthwhile. It may surprise you to know that the next person to visit the ISS commercially could be British chanteuse Sarah Brightman. Commercially developed craft may offer a cheaper ride in the long term. The frontrunner is another computer nerd turned space entrepreneur. Google billionaire Elon Musk's company SpaceX has had amazing success with its composite Falcon rockets, launching its Dragon capsule to rendezvous with the International Space Station and return to Earth safely. A manned version of the Dragon is coming soon, a couple of years, capable of carrying up to 7 astronauts, and SpaceX has also been doing preliminary tests of the Grasshopper, a Falcon first stage capable of controlled, powered landing. Add full reusability to this mix and the prices start to come down dramatically. Again, others are also in this race at different stages of development. Boeing, Lockheed Martin and Blue Origin are all competing alongside SpaceX for NASA contracts using capsule designs, while Sierra Nevada's Dream Chaser space plane is about to undergo its first unpowered glide test. So, now you're in orbit. A couple of days in your capsule, savouring the view and the zero-g, is fine, but after a while, it's beginning to feel a bit cramped. You need a destination. Right now, you have 2 choices. The Chinese are unlikely to let you aboard Tiangong 1, no matter how politely you knock, because there's no one in. So it's the International Space Station for you. B&B rates are available on request from NASA, but they will be steep. How about a space hotel? Who better to go to than Bigelow Aerospace, owned by hotel billionaire Robert Bigelow? He's bought the rights to use NASA's designs for inflatable space station modules, and has actually launched 2 prototypes already. But without a cheap way to get people to orbit, plans for the full-size manned module are currently on hold. For the real adventurer, you could travel further. Space Adventures offers an as-yet-unrealised $100 million trip round the moon in a modified Soyuz. And just this week, rumours surfaced that Dennis Tito, the first space tourist, is conducting feasibility studies on a 500-day flight to Mars and back. Literally, it won't land or go into orbit or anything, starting in 2018 using SpaceX hardware. All of this will be clarified in a press conference, annoyingly scheduled just after the deadline for this week's episode. In reality, I'm not convinced either of these will happen soon. In conclusion then, space experiences are within the reach of many of us, if you're prepared to sell your house. Real space holidays are available now, but only if you have a few tens of millions of dollars to spare. But they are likely to get more available and cheaper within the next 5 to 10 years. But a nice 2 weeks in space, all mod cons, bring the family dog? That will have to wait for a while yet. In the meantime, this is Sean Ellis, hoping James and Liz are enjoying their Earthbound holiday for the Pod Delusion.
Now, essential oils, by which I mean oil. I'm fairly certain that counts as essential, given that if we run out at the moment, we're pretty much screwed. For years now, everyone's been arguing about the best thing to do when we do run out of this oil, but there is one solution that seems to have flown under the radar a bit, and that is thorium. To explain more, here's new contributor, Helly McGrother.
The world currently has a big problem. Fundamentally, we have an energy gap. So first, the problem. A cornerstone of any society is its energy supply. It must be an economic and reliable service, securely sourced, operationally safe and non-polluting. We now face the massive challenge of how to provide such an energy supply for our children's generation. This energy plan will require the continued expansion of renewables with investments in a wider and improved grid and energy storage mechanisms to smooth demand peaks. Continuing efforts to improve efficiency and reduce demand will be needed, but this will not be anywhere near enough to fill the massive gap now opening up in generating capacity. Electricity is increasingly the chosen form of energy supply. For the UK and all nations, capacity has expanded over the last 60 years with 3 major developments. Chronologically, the development and then stagnation of uranium-based solid-fueled nuclear power, then the dash for gas, in which mainly gas turbines replaced coal-fired power stations, and recently the expansion of renewables, currently at about 60% of UK capacity. We have now entered a period of further increase in demand, but also of major transition. The two main developments that drive this transition will eliminate most of our existing generating capacity. We have to slow down the threat of climate change by meeting carbon reduction targets. This means phasing out most of our use of fossil fuels, which is currently at 3/4 of capacity. And we have to replace the capacity lost by closing down the UK's obsolescent uranium-plutonium solid fuel nuclear power stations, now running at 16% of capacity. With the exception of Sizewell B, they are all due to close by 2023. The government has completed the adoption of the carbon reduction targets from the Committee on Climate Change. The reductions, using 1990 figures as a base, are 34% reduction by 2020, 60% reduction by 2030, and 80% reduction by 2050. The corresponding targets for electricity generation from fuels by 2050 are fossil fuels down from the current 76% to 20%, renewables up from 6% to 40%, and nuclear up from 16% to 40%. So the main problem is how to replace fossil fuels. Gas, which is rocketing in price, is no substitute for coal, and the increasing percentage of fracking gas, i.e. from underground explosions, is an environmental disaster that increases the carbon footprint. There is an expectation in some governments and in the nuclear industry that the latest generation of high-pressure solid-fueled uranium-plutonium reactors will at least replace the obsolete reactors and perhaps might replace some fossil-fueled generating capacity. However, there is strong opposition to even the replacement and certainly to the expansion of nuclear capacity based on solid-fueled uranium reactors operating at high pressure. Reactor safety and the generation of long-term highly radioactive waste are the two main obstacles. Recent political developments in Germany and Japan demonstrate this opposition. And all of this leaves a substantial capacity gap in the long and to medium-term UK energy plan. But there is a solution. The solution to our problem is liquid-fueled thorium reactors, known as lifters. Here is a much better alternative to high-pressure solid-fueled reactors burning uranium and plutonium. It is low-pressure liquid-fueled reactors burning thorium. In the 1940s, the Manhattan Project made atomic bombs from uranium and plutonium. In the 1950s, this solid-fuel technology powered submarines and aircraft carriers. Electricity generation followed using the same light-water reactors, even though there were safety concerns, and they were known to be inefficient and produced long-term radioactive waste. For electricity generation, the 1962 US Atomic Energy Authority Kennedy Report recommended the development of thorium technology using molten salt reactors. In 1965-69, this technology was then proven in the successful operation of the MSR experimental reactor at the Oak Ridge Labs in Tennessee. However, in the 1970s, the Nixon administration and the industrial suppliers decided to focus all new investment on uranium and plutonium solid fuel reactors. The success of thorium molten salt reactors then remained hidden until after 2000. Generating electricity by burning thorium in low-pressure molten salt reactors is very safe, 300 more times efficient than uranium and plutonium, and produces virtually no long-term radioactive waste. A person could hold enough thorium to cover their energy needs for a lifetime in the palm of their hand. Thorium molten salt reactors, or MSR liquid fuel technology, is fundamentally very different to the solid fuel high-pressure reactors that we use today. Thorium is hardly radioactive and abundantly available. We have enough for over 100,000 years. Molten salt reactors need no fuel enrichment, no fuel rod fabrication, and no spent fuel reprocessing. MSRs run at low pressure and cannot explode, and can be left safely to cool passively. MSR's higher operating temperature also enables the production of green hydrogen, which can then make green petrol, ammonia, and fertilisers, and consuming waste CO2. Both MSRs and currently used technologies leave short-term fission products. With uranium, this is just waste. MSRs allow 80% of this waste to be isolated and sold as valuable byproducts used in medical treatments and, for example, neodymium, rare earth magnets needed in hybrid cars and wind turbines. MSRs burn 100% of thorium fuel, leaving virtually no long-term radioactive waste, but uranium burns less than 1% and leaves plutonium and much more radioactive waste. MSRs can also consume nuclear waste from uranium-plutonium solid fuel reactors. In terms of weapons proliferation, MSR technology is the most proliferation-proof of all, as confirmed by Obama's Blue Ribbon Commission. Thorium MSR does need some further investment to complete the engineering development, but the feasibility work was completed at the Oak Ridge Labs in Tennessee. The reactor there worked for 5 years. In January 2011, the Chinese announced a reactor program based on thorium MSR, and the French, for Euratom, are now carrying out a prototype MSR project. The UK should join with the French, the EU and the US to invest in the completion of thorium MSR technology and plan for its use to close the energy gap and meet the IPCC targets. This is Helen McGrother collaborating with my dad, John McGrother, for the Pod Delusion.
George Osborne's unquestioning economic competence was once again demonstrated last week when the 4G sell-off didn't quite raise as much money as he thought it would. But I guess, as George said to his friends at Vodafone, what's a billion or so between friends? Anyway, this week Arthur Embleton brings us a fascinating piece about how 4G is going to revolutionise the way we consider how broadband is thought about in this country and why BT should be worried. Here's Arthur with more.
Back in 1984... the state telecoms provider British Telecom was privatised, ushering in a new era of telecoms in the UK. In 1991, it became possible for customers of BT to move to a competitor for their service, but they would still be renting the copper line to their house from BT. In 2000, local loop unbundling was introduced, which allowed customers to pay a provider such as Sky, TalkTalk or Orange for both their telephone service and their line. As far as the customer was concerned, they no longer had to deal with BT. However, BT was still bringing in money. Sky, TalkTalk, Orange, and other providers had to pay BT a sum each month to rent each line. This amount is set by Ofcom and is reviewed annually. This does provide a facade of competition and choice, but ultimately, every customer has to cough up and provide BT with cash each month in order to get their broadband. Currently, the only exception to this are the minority of citizens who are in reach of the cable provider Virgin Media, and those living in Hull, which has its own monopoly provided by Kingston Communications. Over the last 10 years, there has been an explosion in mobile competition. Similar to the situation with landlines, a lot of this is something of a facade, as there are only a few networks with physical infrastructure. Vodafone, O2, Everything Everywhere, and Three. All of the others, such as Giffgaff, Tesco, and Virgin, are paying money out to those with infrastructure. Thanks to there being several providers of the infrastructure and the low variable cost of running a phone network, there has been intense competition and drive to get new services out there. This has seen 99% coverage of the population and large parts of the country receiving 3G. Now, 3G as a technology is somewhat flawed, meaning that it doesn't work so well indoors and compared to home broadband is still slow. This week, Ofcom sold off new spectrum for 4G. This promises faster data access with speeds of up to 100 megabit per second. So, in reality, it will probably be somewhere closer to 20, but this is still a significant improvement over what most of the country currently get on their home broadband. The spectrum was sold off for a total of £2.34 billion, somewhat less than hoped for. The companies that purchase these licences will want to recoup this, and so there will now be a big push to get the transmission towers upgraded with new equipment and get the services rolled out. Initially, there will be a sky-high price and probably low data caps, as we have already seen with T-Mobile and Orange, both of which are brands of Everything Everywhere. This will be used to get as much as possible out of the early adopters. These will likely be locked into a 2-year-long contract. Once the early adopters are locked in and paying for the service, the prices should quickly fall and the data caps rise. After all, it costs a huge amount for them to buy the licenses and equipment for 10 customers, and barely anything for an extra 10,000. BT are likely to have seen this threat on the horizon, which would help to explain why they have been pushing their fibres to the cabinet product. This has been branded as BT Infinity, and involves a fibre optic going to your nearest street cabinet, and then acting as a mini broadband exchange, allowing the last few hundred metres to customers' houses to run over their regular copper lines. This provides much greater speeds. Up until now, the drive for doing this has been Ofcom, which has generally been weak on getting improved broadband speeds. and Virgin, which is limited to selected areas. BT Infinity has been rolled out in recent months to many more rural areas, suggesting that BT can now see the new 4G networks as a serious threat to their business model. Most people, at least those under 35, use a mobile as their primary telephone and only have landline to provide broadband. Without the regular income from millions of customers, they would struggle to find the money to keep all of their exchanges going, and the cost of running the remaining lines would increase as they would lose economies of scale. BT also have an obligation as a monopoly to keep payphones running, and this is generally carried out at a loss. It will be interesting to see what happens to this public service obligation. It is likely that many of the remaining payphones will be scrapped or maybe turned into credit card only ones that are cheaper to maintain. As well as the current mobile networks, there is another player that has won spectrum, Niche Spectrum Ventures, which is the BT subsidiary. BT have announced that this will be put to use for helping to expand their broadband network. They can clearly see the end of copper for certain parts of the country, and so it is worth them spending money to obtain the spectrum to run their own 4G network. If most of the country can get a high-speed connection, then we could see the demise of TV as we know it. Many might choose to watch their show when they want on iPlayer, 4ID and Netflix. For the minority left outside of these areas, not only would they have an internet connection too slow to stream TV, but they might find in some far-off distant time that their TV transmission gets switched off, and most of the country wouldn't mind or care. There are risks to moving more of the nation's communications away from fixed-line services, such as solar storms having more potential to knock out communications, but then parts of the BT network rely upon microwave and satellite links that would be equally disrupted. There is also the very real question of what would happen when there is a loss of power, such as flooding. Right now, most have access to a landline and can use this for dialing the emergency services. All of the lines have backup batteries provided by BT. If the power is cut to a cell tower, then even though your phone may have power, it won't be able to get a signal unless the cell tower has a backup generator. These issues can be addressed, and some issues can be accepted as the cost of progress. Overall, the future for broadband is looking bright and competitive. The physical networks in this country have been expanded from the BT and Virgin duopoly to BT, Virgin, Everything Everywhere, Vodafone, O2 and 3. Of course, we're still likely to have an issue with up to speeds, only now it will be affected by the distance to the cell tower. This is Arthur Embleton, reporting for the Podsolution.
Now, the great thing about the internet is that it gives a platform to the mad ramblings of conspiracy theorists. But at risk of starting a conspiracy theory myself, are the people behind them actually people? This week, Salim Fadli has been speaking to the woman behind a new website, which can generate a new conspiracy theory at the click of a button. So here's Sal with the real truth.
Have you ever noticed that Rachel Maddow has no position on important issues like chemtrails, vaccines causing amnesia in children, and Bigfoot sightings? Isn't it strange that someone would fail to have positions about all of these things? That's because they profit from these evils, which is part of the reason why these evils continue to exist. Rachel Maddow has gone to extraordinary lengths to keep annual visits to Fukushima a secret. But surprised fans with cell phone cameras have been able to bring this unusual fact to light. Those are not my words, but a random article from a new website called verifiedfacts.org. Possibly the ultimate conspiracy theory website, because in addition to containing just about every conspiracy theory that's ever been thought of, it also contains a few billion that have not even yet occurred to David Icke. I spoke with Laura Mitchett. She is the co-creator of verifiedfacts.org, and I began by asking her what inspired the creation of the ultimate conspiracy theory website.
Well, the three of us who made it were sitting around in the house, and our programmer Ian was making a website that helped people and improved their lives. And I told Ian that he should instead make something that would destroy society, because it would be more interesting. And we started talking about how we could destroy society with a website, and we walked down the street to get some food, and by the time we had come back, we had decided that we would destroy society by telling lies. And that's where the idea of making a conspiracy theory website came about. It was essentially just a big joke that we wanted to tell.
But this isn't any old conspiracy theory. I mean, after all, anybody can hack up a little website It's an infinite series of conspiracy theories, and yet every single one of these things kind of rings true. They sort of feel like actual conspiracy theories, the sort of things that you might expect to see in block text on a garish background. Did you intend to create that kind of satire?
Yes, I think it comes from what we used as our source material. We went and we read a lot of websites of actual conspiracy theorists, and some of the sentences in our project are actually taken, are actually very close to actual sentences that we found on conspiracy theorist websites that were modified in order to work with our randomization system.
So, yeah, you mentioned the randomization system, and it's really rather good that obviously you didn't sit down and write a few million conspiracy tracts. These are generated by computer algorithm. But how?
It's essentially a context-free grammar. It's like Mad Lib. We'll have a sentence that has a series of blank spots in it, which are tagged as, you know, this is the name of a famous person, this is the name of a government organization, this is the name of a dangerous object, and we have a selection of nouns that will fill those fields. And then every time the program generates a new conspiracy theory, what it does is it picks sentences that share some of those fields and puts them next to one another. So it sounds like it's a story about a couple of objects rather than a bunch of random sentences crammed together.
And it really does work because the stories have a sort of narrative thread through them, although not too much of a narrative thread. And again, that kind of works out as appropriate given the nature of the material you're trying to satirize.
We felt that conspiracy theories do sound very rambly, and so we wanted our conspiracy theories to have the ability to move from topic to topic sort of incoherently in the way that actual conspiracy theories do.
You've added filler paragraphs that seem to serve no other purpose other than to give you that heightened sense of paranoia that you often get when reading these sites.
Yes, the filler paragraphs don't really say anything, but they do communicate emotions of paranoia or dread, you know, so that the whole story doesn't sound like a series of facts, but rather as like somebody's worries or fears about these conspiracy theories.
Have you ever had anyone complaining about your site? Has anyone actually become upset because you claimed to know the truth between fluoridation and Sasquatch?
No, but we have had conspiracy theorists become very angry at us for spreading disinformation, as they call it. our site was posted a number of times on Reddit, and when it reached the conspiracy theory subreddit, the people there didn't like it very much. They called it a disinfo site. They said that this is exactly the kind of thing that government shills trying to discredit conspiracy theorists would say and do. And their reaction was pretty amusing.
One of the most astonishing things about this site is how simply you were able to recreate the entire genre of writing using some fairly simple canned templates and an algorithm known to every first-year computer scientist. So taking any single page on this site, the average reader might be forgiven for thinking that he or she was reading a genuine conspiracy site. What do you think that says about the form of writing that you were trying to satirize?
When we were working on the site, we didn't exactly sit down and say, this is the grand meaning behind our satire, and we know exactly what we're doing. We were more interested with telling a joke. If you had to take a thesis out of what we made, I guess the thesis would be, haha, this paranoia is so meaningless, it can be modeled with chaos. Our argument then would be that conspiracy theories are meaningless and they are about the theorist's paranoia and not about facts, right? But at the time, we didn't really sit down and plan on saying that, if you know what I mean.
So, is verified facts an exercise in computer-generated humor or an elaborate disinformation campaign run by a big government conspiracy? Laura claims to have created this site as a prank, but how can we be sure? Is she in on the conspiracy, or just a pawn of the Illuminatus? Who knows? This is Salim Fadli, just asking questions for the Pod Delusion.
Now, remember last November when we had the police commissioner elections? Me neither, which is why this week Corey Hazlehurst has been looking at the Electoral Reform Society's new damning report on the government's handling of the elections. To cut a long story short, it sounds like less a case of hello, 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 and more a case of, what? Here's Corey with more.
Has the election of a police and crime commissioner revolutionised policing in your area? No, I thought not. In fact, I'd bet pretty decent money that you couldn't even name the person who was elected PCC for your region in November last year. A report from the Electoral Reform Society this week has quite rightly lambasted the government, holding it completely responsible for a shambles of an election which saw the lowest ever turnout for a peacetime election in Britain's history. In November, elections were held to choose 41 police and crime commissioners for every police force in England and Wales, apart from London. There, mop-haired cyclist and future bringer of the apocalypse Boris Johnson is the elected representative responsible for London's police force. These commissioners actually have quite significant powers. Amongst the more important areas of their remit include the ability to design and implement police strategy, set priorities for the police in their region, including setting the budget, and they can also fire the chief constable. They were initially the brainchild of Tory MP Douglas Carswell. Police commissioners were part of his direct democracy agenda, which is essentially local democracy on steroids, of the kind that can be found in The Plan, a book he co-wrote with notorious Telegraph blogger and Tory MEP Dan Hannan. They were adopted as Tory party policy in their 2010 manifesto and then put into the coalition agreement as well. And in September 2011, the bill to introduce PCCs received parliamentary approval and elections were held in November last year. Turnout in these elections was a risible, record-breaking 15.1%. This beat, if that's the right way to put it, voter turnout to the 1999 European elections, which was by comparison a stonkingly high 23%. As an adopted Brummie, I'm perversely proud to say that the West Midlands was the region with the lowest turnout in the country. In that region, only 11.97% of voters could be bothered to cast their vote, most of whom voted for Labour candidate Bob Jones. Not only that, but it's not as if turnout being this dire was unexpected. The Electoral Reform Society released a report in August last year predicting that turnout would be 18.5%. But it wasn't only the ERS who warned of a possible low turnout. In March, 8 months before the vote, the Electoral Commission warned that, and I quote, "The government has not identified an adequate mechanism for making sure all voters receive information about the candidates in their area. The Commission recommended adding local candidate information to the booklet that they were going to send out to all registered voters, telling them about the police commissioner elections. But this was rejected by the government." Indeed, then-Policing Minister Nick Herbert said in August last year that highlighting the possibility of a record low turnout was carping and a silly season story. Now, the ERS have produced a report detailing exactly what failures were made by the government to produce such a low turnout, and also highlight measures that can be taken to ensure such a farce doesn't happen again. The first major problem they identify was holding an election in November rather than in May, when all other elections are held. Holding the elections in November cost an extra £25 million, when it makes far more sense to hold them in May alongside other elections, which can help drum up extra publicity for the vote. Also, from a common sense point of view, holding any election in winter is a completely stupid idea. In fact, just thinking about holding an election in November turned Gordon Brown from a statesmanlike Prime Minister to a national joke virtually overnight. The second major problem was that voters had insufficient information on all the candidates in order for them to make an informed choice. For their report, the ERS got Populist to conduct a poll of those who didn't vote in the PCC elections. The most popular reason given for not voting in these elections was feeling they didn't have enough information about the candidates to make an informed decision, and this was given by 45% of those non-voters. It's not surprising that voters didn't feel they had enough information, as the government seemed to go out of their way to deny the public access to any information at all. As I've mentioned previously, they refused to send information on local candidates to voters through a voter mail shot. The only official information about candidates could be found online at choosemypcc.org.uk, which excludes the estimated 7 million people in England and Wales, except London, who don't access the internet regularly. You could call a helpline number and request written information about candidates, but this was set up only 23 days before the election and was called by only 200,000 people. Adverts were run on TV publicising the election, but they just comprised of grainy footage of youths committing crimes. It didn't mention anything about what a police commissioner would do, and looked more like a trailer for Crime Watch than a political broadcast. One candidate surveyed by the ERS called the adverts appallingly prejudiced and stereotyped. The third major problem was that there wasn't a level playing field for all the candidates. The Prime Minister, the Policing Minister and the Home Secretary were all on record of saying that they wanted capable, local, independent candidates to fill these roles. Yet the government set a deposit of £5,000 for anyone wishing to stand, which is 10 times higher than the deposit for those who want to stand to be a mayor or an MP. Many other potential candidates were excluded. For instance, police officers were banned from standing, and also those with any convictions, which meant many of those with petty juvenile convictions were banned from standing for the post. For instance, Alan Charles, who was vice chairman of Derbyshire's police authority, was barred from standing because he committed a minor offence when he was 14 years old in 1965, for which he received a conditional discharge. The government also decided that a free mail shot from every candidate would not be funded, probably due to the £30 million cost. Except, of course, as I've said earlier, this could easily have been covered by holding the elections in May and not November. The lack of this mail shot left many independent candidates unable to get their message across because they simply couldn't afford the costs of a proper campaign. Campaigning in a constituency is expensive enough, but these elections were held over regions with an average population of 885,000. The largest of these, Greater Manchester, has a population of over 2 million. One independent candidate, Gillian Radcliffe, withdrew from the South Yorkshire PCC election because of a lack of funds. She said that, "An expert in political campaigns has told me that even doing it on the cheap will cost at least £50,000. I simply don't have that sort of money, or anything like it." And even the main political parties, saving whatever limited money they do have for the 2015 general election, couldn't spend a huge amount campaigning for the election, so nobody really was able to drum up publicity for these elections at all. The failure of the PCC elections also has implications for local democracy, which are also mentioned by the report. Because of this lack of information, voters seemed unconvinced by the need for police commissioners at all. 19% of those who didn't vote said their main reason for not voting was because they disagreed with the idea of an elected police commissioner on principle. The 12 independent candidates who were elected all had experience working in the criminal justice system, suggesting that voters in those areas wished to avoid politicising the police. Introducing police commissioners is an example of top-down devolution, a bit like the government introducing elected mayors, another topic I've covered on a previous Pod Delusion. As the report argues, you can't simply just introduce a new elected official into local politics to cover a democratic deficit. The report argues that change without engagement leads to a lack of participation, and that citizens need to be involved in shaping the local democracy they want, as well as in shaping the local services they want to see. Now it's possible that, if Labour win the 2015 election, that the November 2012 elections will have been the first and only national elections for police and crime commissioners. But the lessons from the appalling running of those elections need to be learned now so that Britain can finally say it has a vibrant local democracy. This was Corey Hazelhurst for the Pod Delusion.
Now, what's the best way to stop school shootings in America? According to one American sheriff, it's to, well, send in an armed posse of men. Sounds bizarre? Then that's only just the beginning, as Tom Hodden now explains.
You may remember a few episodes back I discussed some of the more worrying reactions of the conspiracy fringe to the very real and very tragic rash of shootings in the United States. Oddly, however, when news emerges that has a potential to be a rather sinister turn of events, it goes largely unnoticed by the fringe. This is probably because in the real world, when there is a question of political corruption, authorities overstepping the mark, or rules being bent, it is all very mundane and normally very boring. This is why the Iraqi supergun is nearly forgotten despite being very real and posing a very real danger, while the lizard people ruling us or the chemical cocktail of contrails remain popular in the fringe. As a rule of thumb, never attribute to a new world order that which is easy to explain by good old-fashioned political corruption and boring old incompetence. So what exactly was this development that I would normally expect to have the fringe all a-quivering? Well, normally, if an official were to sanction, armed and uniformed men to patrol schools, there'd be rumblings of a new world order flavoured discontent, especially if schools were going to be patrolled by these men, whether the schools wanted the men in uniforms carrying guns there or not. The armed men in question are the posse of one Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the 80-year-old sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, a man who has more than his fair share of controversy in the past. In his own words, it doesn't matter if the schools like it or not. So, what is the posse? It's a volunteer force that performs a number of duties that many of us would see as worthy of support, such as emergency communications, search and rescue work, helping holiday shoppers in the season to be jolly, and office work that keeps the police going. Other duties are more controversial. Arpaio is something of a crusader against illegal immigration, despite concerns that border enforcement is not in his remit, and the posse aid in immigration sweeps. While investigating President Obama's birth certificate for sign of criminal forgery, and to add to the potential of a disturbing turn of events, there has been some quivering of how effectively the posse have been vetted. It has recently been reported that volunteers have included those with criminal records, domestic abusers, and a sex offender. Not the kind of chaps you might want around a school with a gun. Arpaio may have earned some brownie points on the fringe for giving the birthers a veneer of authority, but his career has gathered far more controversy over considerable time. I already mentioned his war on immigration, which raises an interesting discussion on the extent of his remit and the limit of his power. But a quick glance at Wikipedia gives a somewhat potted list of concerns, touching on unconstitutional prison conditions that turn a prison into a punishment, even for those awaiting trial and yet to be found guilty of any crime, for disturbing failure to properly investigate serious crimes, including 400 sexual offences, and on top of this, the refusal to release the findings from a 4-year internal investigation into the matter. The abuse of his power to target his critics and rivals, a number of feuds with judges and other officials, violation of election law, and the misuse of $100 million of his budget. If the mundane allegations of failing to investigate serious crimes or bullying your rivals are not enough to make you look closer, it would seem as though Arpaio and his office have been part of a conspiracy that ticks many of the boxes you would expect from a conspiracy theory with a big C and big T. James Savile, no, not Jimmy Savile, don't confuse him, filed a complaint for wrongful arrest in 2008, received a settlement of $1.6 million. The arrest was back in 1999, when Savile was just 18. The local television station was even tipped off about the arrest and filmed a high-profile capture. Savile had, it seemed, been planning to murder Sheriff Joe with a pipe bomb. Arpaio went on record stating he would not be scared off by such threats. Yet all was not as it seemed. After 4 years of awaiting trial, and yes, here we should pause to reflect on the controversy about Sheriff Joe's jails, Savile was acquitted in the county superior court. The components of the bomb had been discovered to have been bought with the help of Arpaio's detectives. Quite frankly, this fits all the requirements of a classical conspiracy theory. With an authority figure engaging in shenanigans to fool the populace into supporting him, and by extension, his radical policies. Ironically, because of his birther-friendly investigation, Sheriff Joe appears in fringe conspiracy culture not as a figure of corruption or of manipulation, as his controversies and policies may have warranted, but as a staunch figurehead, the heroic crusader using his posse to prove that Obama was not actually American or not actually valid to be president. It seems likely that if C.T. Law remembers him at all, it will be as a little man fighting the giants of the man. James Savile and the victims of 400 sex crimes from a 3-year period will probably go unmentioned in the law. I am left with an uneasy feeling and cannot help but wonder where else armed men may be sent, if their protection has been asked for or not. This has been Tom Hodden for The Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, Edinburgh Secular Society have been challenging their city council over the enforcement of religious observance in schools. To find out more, Sean Slater has been speaking to a member of the society. Here's Sean.
My name's Sean Slater, reporting for the Pod Delusion. I'm talking to Gary McClelland, who's the chair of the Edinburgh Secular Society. Gary, welcome to the Pod Delusion.
Thank you, Sean, and thanks for having me. It's nice to talk to you. Just to give you a bit of background about our petition is launched by a parent called Veronica Whitgreen, who lives in Edinburgh. The Edinburgh Secular Society is supporting this petition, which calls on the Edinburgh City Council to call for a poll of local electors in Edinburgh on a motion to discontinue the Act of Religious Observance. They were using a clause, Clause 8, which was in the original 1872 Act, which was then updated in the 1980 Education Act. So basically our petition is designed to call on the support of local teachers, parents and residents of Edinburgh to have a debate on how much religion they want in their schools. Now, at the Edinburgh Secular Society, we hold the idea of comparative religious studies very important. We think it's an integral part of the education system. It's right and just that people, young people especially, should learn about different religions and faith positions throughout the world. But we believe that these should not be imposed as truth and that there should be an equal opt-out for those who do not wish to believe these.
So is the status of religious observance then more of a preaching, or is it just, what's the actual status of religious observance in these schools?
The religious observance, as I said, dates back to the 1872 Act. At that time, that was when the Church of Scotland gave up ownership over the schools in Scotland.
Okay.
And it was always very much interpreted and practiced to be a confessional approach to mostly Christian prayers, Bible studies and other acts of religious instruction, as it was originally known. So it varies very much from religious education or religious and moral education that we would know now.
So at the moment, the children in the schools, are they mostly high schools or are they primary schools or all areas?
Yeah, all areas. The religious observance requirement is a requirement under law, under the 1980 Education Act, and applies to all schools, primary, secondary, denominational as well as non-denominational, private as well as state. So it applies throughout the board. It is our belief that we cannot find evidence of any other move to discontinue religious observance from the Clause 8. Now, the Scottish Government released in 2005 a circular which was designed to give some structure and some guidance on how to implement RO in schools in Scotland, in non-denominational schools in Scotland. At that time, they focused their literature very much on the Christian traditions of Scotland, and Christianity was seen as at the forefront of religious observance. They updated this legislation in 2011, and it very much still focuses on Christianity, and we believe that it's time that we had a debate about whether or not religious observance has a place in our state schools. The religious observance, although it does not call upon head teachers and schools to require them to invite in external groups, it does promote that. It does promote the schools to bring in external agencies. And we've found from our own research and from testimony from parents and teachers that some of these groups are quite evangelical. They are very, they try very hard to influence the school and to influence the ethos of the school. And this is often done without parental consent or knowledge. And a YouGov poll that was conducted by the Humanist Society of Scotland last year, it was found that only 20% of parents were originally told about the right to withdraw their children from religious observance and religious and moral education, and we believe that that is not acceptable. Parents have a right to know that they can withdraw their children from these services, and they should be told about this. Now, I have been inundated with emails and contacts from teachers and parents throughout Edinburgh and also throughout Scotland, from Aberdeen, from Glasgow, from Fife, from all over, from parents and teachers who are shocked by what goes on in their school, by the amount of interference from churches and faith groups, and we think it's time that these were all brought out into the open and discussed.
So the petition that's been set up by Veronica is... So that's calling on Edinburgh Council to have a review of the situation, or just to have a debate, or what exactly does it require of Edinburgh Council to do if the required signatures are raised?
Sure. Well, we have already exceeded the required signatures within a few days of the petition going live.
Okay, that was 500 or 1,000?
It was, well, again, there's a bit of dubiety. The minimum requirement is 500, although the Edinburgh City Council can hold a debate at the 250 point if they deem it appropriate.
Okay.
Now, we were a bit worried about getting the numbers for this, frankly, but within a few days of the petition going live, we had over 800 signatures. We received coverage in BBC News, Colkay, various different local papers. And as I said to you before, I've had been inundated with contacts from parents, from teachers, from residents of Edinburgh and all over Scotland to say that they think it's about high time we had this debate. So basically what the petition is calling on is basically requiring under Section 8 of the 1980 Education Act, it's requiring Edinburgh Council to hold a poll of local electors, which is the voting public of Edinburgh, and it's requiring them to vote on a motion to continue or discontinue religious observance in the local area. Now, the petition will be reviewed by the Petitions Committee. We think that might take place in April, although we're not sure. At that point, Edinburgh City Council will have three options. They can dismiss our claim, they could pass it to Education Committee or another committee to take evidence on this, or they could decide to hold the vote. Now, we are not sure what will happen. There obviously will be a financial cost involved with holding a vote, but again, it's really going to be up to the council to decide what way they want to take it forward.
So if they decide to dismiss it completely, is there any further action that you can take?
No, Edinburgh City, if they dismiss it completely, Edinburgh Council will not consider it again, at least for 2 years. They'll consider the matter to have been discussed, and again, it won't be discussed for another 2 years at least. The next port of call could be to take this matter to the Scottish Government, to Holyrood, to ask them to review the religious observance requirement of the Education Act, although I think the chances of that being reviewed are very unlikely. The Scottish Government in their 2011 circular very clearly said that they're in favour of religious observance and they want to have it, the instance of it increased.
Okay, and that's the Scottish Government under the SNP, or is that all party support for that?
The only publication that we have is from the 2011 circular on RO, which is the SNP government, but previous administrations had also indicated their support for religious observance, such as 2005.
Okay, so do you think if you are successful in Edinburgh, are you confident that this may spread to other areas or councils in Scotland?
Well, I know, for example, that there are similar groups in Fife, Aberdeen and Glasgow considering to launch a petition on the same motion. So I think we have raised this to the fore. And one of the most interesting things has been to see, a bit like yourself, Sean, how many people weren't aware of this requirement and how many people didn't simply know that these things take place. And various different groups have came back to us and said, look, religious observance, it's a really nice thing, it's very open, it's philosophical. Also, in the 2011 circular, the Scottish Government requested that the name that religious observance should be referred to as Time for Reflection, mirroring that of the Scottish Parliament. Now, the only problem that we have with that, Sean, is that very clearly the legislation relates to religious observance, so it is by definition a religious event. Now, we think it's about time, like I said, that we have a debate about this and that we really look into the nitty-gritty of what's happening. There may be various examples throughout the country of religious observance being open, inclusive, holding very many faith positions and none. For example, I'm sure you'll find examples of humanist groups going in and making a religious observance event. And these are probably very good things, but the problem with the legislation as it stands is that it allows for these other more organised, more evangelical groups also to get access to our schools. So we're not calling for a complete removal or ban of religion in schools. We're just saying that this policy as it stands allows an open door policy for various groups to get access to schools, and we think that they need to look at it a bit more.
Okay, well, thank you. That's been very informative. So how can people, if they do wish to sign the petition, I take it they'd have to be a resident of Edinburgh to do so?
That's right. In order to sign the petition, which is available at the Edinburgh Secular Society website, you have to be a resident in Edinburgh on the voters' roll. But like I say, please stay tuned to the Edinburgh Secular Society website, because I'm sure we'll be sharing details of various other campaigns that are going to be kicked off in Scotland around the same idea.
Okay, that's great, Gary. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
This is Sean Slater reporting for the Pod Delusion.
A
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3 years' worth of archives. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, if you're into those sorts of things. And if you have enjoyed the show this week, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. We really appreciate all donations as they help us keep doing this thing every single week. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Helly and John McGrother, Arthur Embleton, Sean Ellis, Salim Fadley, Sean Slater, Corey Hazelhurst, Tom Hodden, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Another fish, Mrs. Otter.
Oh, I can't, Mrs. Other Otter. I can't leave it an hour before I go swimming in the river. That holt won't clean itself, you know.
Oh, they were round here again this morning.
Were they? Who were?
Them. The humans poking around our holt, taking notes.
Oh, the otter spotter.
With the jotter.
Well, what do they want, then?
I've no idea, but I saw an article about them in the Daily Mole.
Oh, what? There was an interesting article in the Daily Mail.
One, amongst all the other drivel about immigrant ferrets taking all our fish.
What did it say, then?
Researchers studying over a decade's worth of dead otters in Britain have concluded that...
Yeah, they've got too much time on their hands.
Concluded that pollution is most likely the cause of penis shrinkage in the water-loving mammals.
Oh, they think our husbands have small manhoods.
Otterhoods.
Oh, otterhoods, because of the pollution in the water supply.
Look, Mrs. Otter, you and I both know that isn't true.
That's right, Mrs. Other Otter. The size difference is purely because they've started measuring them rather than just asking the male otters how big it is.
Exactly. I don't know about your husband, but my Jeff lies about everything. He reckons he can balance pebbles on his.
Yeah, well, my husband's as big a liar as yours. He said if he swam on his back, he could put a sail on it and float to America. Back when we was courting, he wooed me out of a bevy of beauties by pretending that he was best friends with Rayleigh.
Rayleigh?
Yeah, you know, Rayleigh. Rayleigh Otter.
Oh, he's a hunk. Still, I do love my husband. He may not be well endowed, but although some people think lying is totally unacceptable, I'm weaselly satisfied.
Still, what do researchers know anyway? They say that female otters stay faithful to the same male.
We must stop talking about it. Jeff's just coming back in, no doubt from another unsuccessful beaver hunt.
We'll talk about it later. All this chat about Rayleigh has definitely got me otter under the collar.